Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit in creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have two very special guests. We have a lovely mother-daughter treat. We have Amy Guber, who is the daughter, who is a women's life coach, connects and supports women while leading her company's Better Together events and Wandering Women Travel. And we have her mom, Gwen Borden, who created and served as founding director of a first-of-its-kind bereavement center on Long Island, New York. She later counseled hundreds of widows and families during the harrowing aftermath of 9/11. Welcome, Amy and Gwen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So nice to have you here. So they just co-wrote a book, My Mother Always Says, and I recommend it highly if you're a mother, if you're a daughter, whoever you are. It's really great, great, great lessons from Gwen and Amy, and it's really wonderful. So what would you guys like to say about writing this book together? How was that?
I gave birth to Amy. She gave birth to the book.
Yeah. Oh, okay. But you wrote your stories.
Yes.
Did you?
Yes. How it all sort of came about is that I found myself quoting my mother all the time. I mean, I did throughout my life, but more often recently, let's say in the past 5 or 8 years, I just kept either whether through my work or even just, you know, with my friends, I would say, oh, well, as my mother would say, well, my mother would say, my mother would have said this. And then it made me realize that I should put these lessons down because it's really life lessons. They're really sort of sayings that you can use to understand your own life, you know, have good self-reflection and then get through challenges. So I said to my mother, let's write this book, but I wanted a lot of it to be in her voice and, you know, her words. And so she did a lot of like explaining and I did a lot of typing.
A lot of talking myself when I was born, experiences I had growing up, because I've had a long and extremely interesting life. So it was easy for me to recount the way life was for me as a little girl, as a teenager, as a young woman, as a mother. So it just flows. It's your life. You could talk about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So can we go back to when you were a kid? Because that just stands out with me. When you were born, and you came home from the hospital and your sister had just been diagnosed with polio. So your mother handed you off and dealt with your sister, understandably.
But let me say in my mother's defense, my mother was the kind of woman who always said she drove herself to the hospital to have me. She did. My mother was one of those women who could do anything. And when she came home from the hospital with a new baby, she found out that her 4.5-year-old was crippled. She had been dancing in the aisles at a movie with her grandmother, and she collapsed. And in those days, this was a huge polio epidemic, and the outcome was usually pretty grim. They put these kids into braces, and they were crippled for life. But my mother, with an 8th grade education, somehow, I have no idea, had heard about the Kenny treatment. And she organized a bathtub brigade from all the members of our large family. And people came over and put her lair in the bathtub. And she moved her little legs day and night. And the truth is she had no bad effects of that polio in her long life in her 90s. So my mother was in her own way a heroine. And she had this little baby, and there was a big family, so she handed me off to my father's youngest sister, who was 17, my Aunt Ruth. And I must have been a good baby. I must have thrived and ate and slept and whatever. And they just handed me around, and I had lots of mothers. Ultimately, I came to see that there were lots of good people in the world when I look back on it. But I was handed around, not by my own mother and not by my own father, but by all these other good people. So that was a life lesson learned early in life. There are good people in this world who can take care of you if you thrive on your own.
Right. But later you said, and tell me if I'm getting this wrong, that your mother never bonded with you.
We never bonded with each other. There's a bonding period. You know, you see that with ducklings. Are you my mother? They'll follow. That period, that crucial period, that early year, I did not bond with my mother because she wasn't mothering me. She was mothering her other child who was in dire need of a mother. So I bonded with my Aunt Ruth, as a matter of fact. She became my spiritual mother. But I mean, my mother was still my mother, in fact.
Right.
I lived with her, and she took care of me the best she could. But this was an era, you understand, maybe you don't, when people were put on their own very early. My mother was the youngest of six girls. I'm sure she was put out to pasture early, do this, do that. So the independence came from, if you could do it, you did it. And my father was the oldest son of six children, and he too was put on his own early. So that was the tradition of my family. So the bonding couldn't happen because my mother wasn't physically taking care of me.
Right. So was she different with your sister?
Well, my sister, because she was a skinny little thing, and I was this chubby, robust, healthy baby, became the family invalid. My parents always hovered over her. She was like a rail. She was the smallest, skinniest little kid. And they did hover over her because she had been so close to death, so close to danger. And that was never my role. My role was happy-go-lucky. They used to call me Gwenny. Gwenny was a happy, smiling baby who walked early, talked early, made friends. I was like no trouble. So it's the squeaky wheel that gets the attention.
Right. But the other thing that stuck with me was when you were, I think it was 10, during the war with the blackouts, and you're home by yourself.
Well, again, the exigencies of life. We moved to Virginia right after Pearl Harbor. My father was doing business there. My mother, we moved into a house that was unfinished, unheated, no toilet facilities because the house wasn't finished. This was wartime Norfolk, Virginia, with the biggest naval base on the East Coast. And so I was, again, this independent kid. I went to school with a key around my neck because my mother worked, my father worked, and my sister was in high school. So off she went to high school, and I walked the long distance to the Emma Willard School, where I was the only Jewish child in the entire school, and started every day singing Onward Christian Soldiers. I learned every word of it. And because I was so smart and came from New York, I was years ahead of all the other kids. So I had an easy time in school. I didn't need any parenting. I really didn't. And my mother, because she worked full time, I came home early with the key around my neck. And my mother expected me to help her clean the house, which children at that time did. Unlike the coddled children of this era, at that time, children were expected to help out in the house.
Yeah.
So I would scrub the kitchen floor because my mother wouldn't use a mop. And I learned to make a poetry. I mean, I was just that kind of kid. I had that gift. So I recited poetry to myself while I scrubbed the floor. And I made up stories for myself. Now, the all-night blackouts were part of the regimen of life in Norfolk, Virginia. Because of the base, there were all-night blackouts on a regular basis. My mother became an air raid warden. And so she would be walking the streets with our big Irish setter. My father, at that point, had moved to more fertile fields of business. He was in Texas. My sister was out dating. She was a teenager. She was, you know, 15, 16. And so I was left alone in the house with the curtains drawn, no lights, no radio, no nothing. And I used to say to myself, I'll be all right. I'll be all right. So I became my best friend. Yeah. You understand, this was a reaction to a situation that was not uncommon during that period. My parents were not unusually uncaring. It's just that that's the way, I mean, I was a very capable child. So I got through those nights, put myself to bed. I would read my books under the covers with a flashlight because I was a great reader. So in the end, it turned out to be a positive experience because I learned to be on my own. My creativity flourished. So I see it as now a building block, not a bad thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's great. Like some people could have turned into a victim and been resentful and all that. Or maybe they didn't back then. I mean, I've heard a lot of stories, orphans, people left, you know, a boy. I mean, now he's in his 80s, but he was left alone in an orphanage. His father left him in a hotel in New York for a month by himself at 10.
It was very common in those days for single father parents to drop their kids off in an orphanage. They said someone will take care of them. So it was a time when parenting was not this protective, loving behavior as we all know it in this era, which is totally the other way. And I guess if you didn't have the gifts in you, and the thing I want to remind people about is this. The next door neighbors were very nice to me. I would go over there. Ebby Coates taught me how to bake and how to cook. She welcomed an intelligent 10 or 11-year-old to help her with her own babies. So it was a time when, you know, people helped each other. And I never felt afraid during that time. It was just a long night. Mm-hmm. But it left me well equipped to be on my own, to not be afraid of the dark. It served me later in my life when my husband died and I was all alone. And I said, I've been alone before. This is not so terrible. Mm. I mean, I don't mean to sound like a Pollyanna. I am just...
No. But I'm thinking, as you're talking, you probably didn't have all the scary movies that we see now where kids are so terrified.
What a scary war outside our door. We had people talking about the Nazis coming and the submarines being blown up and air raids. No. There was plenty of talk of fear. That was true. There's always been fear in the world. How you adapt to the anxiety is the other thing. So for me, I took the way that worked for me inside. I played Let's Pretend. I kept saying, I'll be all right. I had a special pass on my palm that said, please excuse Gwen. I made that up as my own protection, which is called adaptation.
Mm. How did you know to do that? You just did. That was just how.
I swear, the good fairy at my birth gave me that gift of a feeling of confidence in myself that I will always be all right. That I will, and I had wherewithal to take care of myself. That's a gift. Resiliency cannot be learned. Mm. You can by experience. And this was just learning on the job. I guess if I'd been a different kind of kid and I cried and I was in trouble, they've had to do something with me. I don't know what. I mean, I had friends whose parents were home and whatnot. My mother was an air raid. My mother was a different kind of woman. I mean, as afraid of the dark as she went out and was an air raid warden. My father was an adventurous entrepreneur. He traveled to Texas during the war and left us. So we had different circumstances and parents who modeled for us, this is the way you do things. You just do them. You don't whine. You just do them.
Yeah. It seemed like people were stronger back, you know, stronger back then. You weren't coddled. That's for sure.
But we remember ever reading Viktor Frankl's great book about the concentration camps. Mm. What doesn't kid you makes you stronger.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
For some people, there may have been dire consequences. I don't doubt that there were people who had total breakdowns and did not prosper as I did. Mm-hmm. But I was lucky. Not part of being a lucky person with things inside yourself and the ability to somehow husband them at a time when you need them. So I call myself a lucky woman that I had that.
Yeah. Wow.
Believe me, this was not well thought out. I didn't know.
No, you, No, it was probably, you know, as you told your story, you got to see your lessons, right? And how it strengthened you.
But I had that gift. You see, the ability to be, to see the glass half empty or half full is either gift. I always saw it half full. I'm an optimist by nature. I always feel I'm going to be all right. And I have been for 93 years.
Wow.
And a half. I'll be 94 in July.
Wow. And Amy, would you say, are you a half full person too?
I think I'm a half full person, but I maybe not as much as my mom is in terms of like the important serious things, because I'm not that you're not, but I tend to be a critical thinker. So I'm always thinking of like, you know, how to do it better and what could go wrong. And, you know, I sort of see that. My family calls me the CSO, which stands for Chief Safety Officer. So I'm the one who's like, don't go over there. Don't step over there. We can't do that. So I don't know. I mean, I do think overall I'm optimistic in general, and I do move forward, and I'm all that action, which you mentioned. So if you're really not, if you don't believe in yourself, then you can't do those things.
Mm-hmm. She's also a caretaker. When Amy and I just came in from a walk, she's saying, watch the lip here, watch this other, because I am no lady. So she's always watching where I walk, even though I am a walker since I've been 1 year old and I never had a fall. She's taking care of me. She's that way with her family. So she's a caretaker, which is a positive thing. I don't see anything wrong with that.
Hmm. Yeah.
I think whatever we do is right. How do you like that?
Well, I think it's great. My mom, I forgot to mention this. I was going to dedicate today's show to her. She's 95. Mm-hmm. We were in the hospital with her. Hopefully she's getting out today. And, you know, just prayers for Elaine, who got stuck in Pennsylvania. Well, she's in Pennsylvania with my sister. So she's been in the hospital since Saturday when she collapsed, and they're trying to figure out why. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we're dedicating this to Elaine.
Your mother grew at 95. I'm interested. How has she been before she was in the hospital?
Her physical health is great. She has dementia, so her short-term memory is pretty much gone. She knows who we are. You know, she's very intelligent. She's a lot of fun. She's a great patient. All the nurses love her, you know.
See, that was the penalty we pay for living so long. Mm. We end up living so long that we begin to outgrow what was given to us. You know, when man came out of the trees, man lived to be 30.
Mm-hmm.
Now we live so long, our bodies were not constructed for 95 and 93 years. My husband's 98. We were not constructed for this long life. So things go wrong. They wear out. It is the price you pay for longevity.
Right. Well, it seems to me like, I mean, my father, he died at 92. His brain was fine, but his body went.
Well,
you know, he had cancer and stuff like that. My mother's body, like she could, you know, until a couple months ago, she could play tennis. Mm-hmm. You know, she's amazing.
Well,
it was the brain. So it seems like, I'm not saying that's always the case, but it's one or the other. And I used to think I got to pick. So I'd be like, which do I want? And then I realized, oh, that's not my choice.
Good thinking.
You don't have to pick.
No, fill the water. You don't have to think about it. And some people are lucky like me and have both.
Yeah, that's amazing.
But that is just the luck of the genes and the gifts at birth. I really believe that. Mm. That is a stroke of luck. Wow. That both of them together.
Yeah.
But everybody is not so lucky. And everyone doesn't have the gift of the long life. Your mother's had the pleasure of a long life. So have I. There are consequences for that.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, how was it being Jewish down in Virginia as the only person? Because I am Jewish too. And when I was working with the army in Germany, the American army, but in the 80s. And, you know, when they found out I was Jewish, they were like, like, they couldn't believe that they had been talking to me. You know what I mean? That I didn't have horns and all that stuff,
that's
really.
Exactly. It's like when people go to the zoo. So I was this Jewish kid in this school, and they didn't, but I was what they would ultimately decide was a good Jew. because I didn't want to sing Armed with Christian Soldiers. I was smart. I helped the teachers. I made friends. And because I could adapt, you melt into it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not being the stereotypical thing they think it is. You see, there's a people who don't know what it is. I mean, there are people who've never seen a black person. So they have all kinds of stereotypes about that. And depending on when and where in their lives they encounter their first specimen, it's a species, begin to learn. It's a lifelong process. So I did very well down there. I have to tell you, I had no problem. My father did business down there. And these Southerners would say, oh, Mr. Drucker, you're a white Jew. Well, I guess that was considered a compliment. They didn't know any other Jews, really. I don't know who else they were talking about.
Wow. And then when did they move back up north?
When the war ended, we moved back north, where I was now, instead of being 3 years ahead of everybody, 3 years behind everybody. Well, the Southern schools are not famous for their advancement. But I managed with that, too, including my learning disabilities, because I was given the gift of prodigious memory.
Oh, so that's how you got by.
Yeah, with prodigious memory. Lucky me. So I was a good student. I did well. I have done well everywhere. I have 2 master's degrees, and I can't spell. And I can't count. You want to know more? You don't want to know more.
So what was, Amy, was it your daughter with the, Jesse with the dyslexia, right?
Yes.
That along with the other stuff for me.
Yeah.
Was yours dyslexia too, Gwen?
Well, hers was not diagnosed, but she has dyslexia.
In those days, there was no such thing as a diagnosis.
I think you do have it.
I know I do.
So it wasn't diagnosed, but yeah.
Undiagnosed. There was no such thing. When I was in high school, we took the Regents to New York State, and the geometry Regents, they called me down to the math office after I handed in my paper and said, could you tell us, how did you possibly prove these triangles, both congruent and similar in 3 steps? I said, I don't know. Well, because it wasn't possible. So they decided I was just one of these idiot savant kids who did A work everywhere else because of my memory. And they passed me. They kept passing me because they said, there's no point in her doing this again. She'll never do it. Now, that might not happen today, but that was the kid I was. And to this day, I count on my fingers when I play bridge. How about that? I play bridge counting on my fingers for the points.
But do you think it helped that you didn't get a quote-unquote diagnosis because you didn't know that there was anything wrong? And so...
No, I had magical thinking. I kept thinking, look how lucky I am. They keep passing me. I didn't overanalyze why. I was just happy to be and do what I did. And all I'm saying is, you can live with a disability that never gets diagnosed.
Right.
People don't know what to do with you. But had I been diagnosed, I may have gone further and become a Nobel Peace Prize winner. Who knows? Nothing helped for me.
Wow. Okay. So you get married, you have your kids, and then?
And then my husband dies. Oh, that. And then what happens? I had a very full, rich life having children and the life I lived. And then my 49-year-old husband missed the tennis ball on the court. That's what happened. He missed the tennis ball and went to the ophthalmologist and then to the neurologist, and he had a 10-week death sentence put on him because he had a tumor that was benign, but killed him anyway.
But they didn't really know, right? They never did the testing to see if it was benign or malignant.
What they do was...
They didn't do a biopsy.
No, they didn't. There was no point. How they knew was he was given... We were told the only thing that might help if it were malignant, if, would be cobalt treatment. So he had the treatment. It never shrunk a centimeter. But it didn't matter. But the diagnosing doctor at Long Island Jewish Hospital, Dr. Dathanson, said to me, Gwen, benign or malignant, this is going to kill him because of the size. And that was the death sentence, regardless of whether it was benign or malignant.
So until he missed the tennis ball, I mean, did he never miss a shot?
He
doesn't mean that. She means he didn't see it coming across the net. She doesn't mean he missed the shot.
No, he didn't see it.
Yeah, but you keep saying he missed the.
Well, when
she means when you he couldn't see it. It was like he saw it and then he didn't see it and then it was right there.
You play tennis, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
in the air all the time. He had no symptoms whatsoever. He never had a headache.
Wow.
He never took an aspirin.
So it was a visual thing. He all of a sudden couldn't see the ball, and that's why.
He had dumbbell tumor behind his eyes. Both eyes. So it was a fast thing, but it came from nowhere. Tall, he had some help.
Isn't it amazing? Like, he could, like, one day, boom, he can't see, and then,
No, it doesn't happen that way. Your seeing gets fuzzier and no. You don't go blind.
No, she's saying that he couldn't see the ball and then that's what spiraled.
So he went to the ophthalmologist. What do you do?
Yeah.
The ophthalmologist must have looked back there and said, I think you better go see a neurologist. So we went to New York. He drove himself into the city. We lived on Long Island.
Wow.
Came back. And until he collapsed at the house, and then they said, you better go to the... In other words, we couldn't even get an MRI machine in those days. There were only three in New York State, and he never got an MRI machine. That's the way it was then.
How did they even know it was there? How could they see it?
An angiogram. They did an angiogram. He went into Long Island Jewish. He had collapsed, and he went into Long Island Jewish, and they did the angiogram, and they said, there's a tumor back there. That's this Dr. Nathanson said, there's a big, bad, nasty growth behind his eyes, a dumbbell tumor.
And were you there when they said this? Were you with him?
There when, you have to laugh. I wasn't there when they did the angiogram. But the next morning at 6 a.m., my husband was on the phone saying, get me out of this place. With the brain tumor, get me out of this place. They want me to go into a room. I don't know what they want me to do. So they were giving him radiation treatment without telling him what it was. And he had enough brain left to say, I'm getting out of here. And I took him out of Long Island Jewish without medical clearance because my husband wanted to go home. And I said, I already had spoken to the doctor. If he's going to die, he's going to die at home and be comfortable. So I took him home. That's what we did. And when he collapsed at home, he went back into a local hospital because he could no longer. He was a 6-foot-tall man who couldn't walk, who couldn't stand. It wasn't he couldn't see. It was a very.
Because it was pressing on whatever.
It was behind his eyes. Mm. That's where you see from.
Yeah.
Wow. You know what I mean? Yeah. But I have to tell you that I have never been a rule follower, as you can tell. That's been good. I like being an iconoclast. So when we had the cobalt treatment, which was useless, the radiologist said to me, you know, he's going to be good as new. I said, what planet are you on? He's never going to be good as new. Anyway, now in those days, and I guess it's the same today, when you stop getting treatment, the hospital says you can't stay here. Mm. So when he finished whatever the 6 weeks of cobalt was, the alternative was a nursing home or I don't know what. And I said, I'm taking him home. He's going to be at home and we will take care of him at home. And luckily I had a lot of money. So I turned her room, we moved her out into a hospital room, all the equipment. I had nurses around the clock for him because he was totally helpless. And he died at home in his own house with his children coming in and coming and going with school, eating the food he liked, and just looking at his hands all the time saying, I guess he would say, what's wrong with me? Mm. Really never understood because the frontal part of the brain was gone. But he had a good, painless death. Mm. He died in his bed 8 in the morning. He just stopped breathing. And I always felt good. If I couldn't save his life, which I damn well tried, I assure you, I was on the phone night and day trying to find out what to do for it. And every doctor I spoke to and every scientist I spoke to said, if I knew the answer, I would win the Nobel Prize. We don't know where these come from. We don't know how to treat them. Mm. Hmm. So he had a good death, and I felt positive that he had died in his own place and his own children had a chance to be with him so that they weren't burdened with this terrible guilt of, I should have seen my father, I should have done that. None of that. They were there. Amy would do her homework in his room. And so we made the best of a really bad situation, is all I can say. Because in those days, nobody did this at home. Nobody. And everybody who knew me said, you are crazy to do this at home. I said, you watch me, we're going to do it. And we did.
So you had 4 weeks, if my math is correct, having him at home? If it was 10 minus the 6?
6 weeks in the hospital where we were there day and night. Yeah, he was getting 10. He was diagnosed in October, and he was dead February 5th, 1975.
Yeah, wow.
And I'll tell you, never had a headache. It's an unbelievable story.
And what, as wonderful as all that is, so I think a big crucial part of the book is there are no bad experiences, just the ones you don't learn from. So then, now, my father died. I was 15. My brother was 16, and we are getting ready to go to college. I'm going to tell your story now, since I feel like I need to be useful.
You are useful.
And so, well, say something. So my mother did not want us to feel like we couldn't go away to school. So she kind of hatched a plan of what she was going to do next for herself. And she applied to law school and social work school. And law school put her on a wait list, and social work school accepted her. So she went to social work school, which is smart. And she was moving forward in her life, right? And we were going off to college. And so she then went to social work school. I think she was 44.
44. Three of us were in school at the same time. Three of us. I went to the bank to withdraw money. And they said, you know, the law is when you take out this much money, you have to tell us what it's for. I said, well, it's three tuitions. Bill's at Harvard. She's at Cornell. I'm at Adelphi. Those tuitions account for this amount of money.
So she went to social work school. I am determined to keep this going. She went to social work school, and toward the end of the second year, she had an internship at Family Service Agency. And as the schooling part, she had to write a paper on program development. Mm. So she wrote her paper on creating a bereavement center, which did not exist. As I like to say, it's not that there wasn't bereavement. People died and people were sad about it, but they didn't have the kind of bereavement support that we're used to today. So she writes this. Is this good that I'm telling this?
Yeah.
So she writes this paper, and the professor says, you know, this is fabulous. You need to give it to the director where you're interning. So she's now like a 44-year-old intern, and she slides the paper under the door of the director of this family service agency, who calls her, I think, that night, and says, this is a fabulous idea. We are going to do it. You're going to be the director, and we're going to get this going. And so that became what she did with her career. Now she's 44, so she has a whole career. We now go to college, and she gained all this experience in creating this bereavement center, in counseling all different types of people. And then 20 years later came 9/11, and she was poised and ready to help hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of widows. So I really feel like we have to underscore the whole point of the book is there are no bad experiences and finding the silver lining. That's one lesson. There are no bad experiences. Only the ones you don't learn from is one of 25 lessons like that.
Well, have you
Sorry, but I felt like
we had no forgotten there.
I
was staying on the timeline. But when I developed this quote bereavement center, which was right out of my head, there wasn't even a course on bereavement in social work school. There was no field for it.
So was this the first bereavement center like anywhere, like in the country?
Newsweek magazine came down and interviewed us and stayed for my parents' group. Because it was a new concept, as she said, was bereavement. And my experience was I was widowed for 2 years. I knew more than everybody else because there was no way to learn about this.
And weren't they not paying you? They said they started this and we're not going to pay you.
Sal Ambrosino, who was the director of Family Service, a wonderful man, said, we love the idea, but we can't pay you. So here's what we'll do. Whatever fees you collect, and this was a sliding fee scale community service, you can keep whatever the sliding fee scale service. You'll pay as you go.
Oh.
No. Well, as luck has it, a call came in from WOR, the big TV station. They were giving Family Service a 1 minute public service announcement on TV.
Free.
Free.
Like
and,
donating it.
And they said to me, Gwen, you go in and do that. So help me. I went into New York. I had written out a 1 minute thing that said, if you are grieving a loss, call us at Family Service. My name is Gwen Schwartz. And guess what? They played it, of course, 2-3 in the morning because they weren't going to lose commercial time. But when are people who were grieving up 2-3 in the morning, the phone was ringing off the hook at Family Service. We were flooded with people. We were an overnight success. And pretty soon, I was bringing in so much money, they said, you know, we're going to stop that and put you on salary.
Right. They didn't want her to be paid.
Because I was getting so much money in.
Oh, they changed. Yeah. Oh, wow. All right. We got to take our commercial break. We're a little overdue, but I didn't want to interrupt this amazing stuff. So, all right. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
And thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. If you want to bring experiential social-emotional learning to your schools, to your businesses, to your homes, go to them. You can find them at KikoriApp.com. And especially the newest thing is that parents are loving this because they do the activities with their children, especially teenagers, who now start opening up, sharing. And by doing that, they can now learn better, but also connect better. So it's almost magic. Go to KikoriApp.com and check it out. And then my books, as always, I'll start with my 3rd book first. Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. I wasn't born a positive thinker. I was born a negative thinker. Always tried to change that about myself and finally accepted it as my gift. So these are tools and techniques for getting from the dark side of life where I could get stuck on to the fun side. So if you're one of those, check that out. This book was my 2nd and it was Real Talk. As a people-pleasing, pleasant phony, I didn't know how to speak up. So when I learned, I realized, wow, life is a lot better when you can speak. So the subtitle, How to Say the Things You've Never Said so You Can Have the Things You've Always Wanted. It really helped me. It's short, but it's effective. And then this was my 1st book, the 2nd piece of French toast. This is when I was living on the dark side and didn't even know there was another side, and how I got back to the other and created a life I loved. The subtitle, so you can guess what it's about. If marriage was my dream, why was I numbing myself? Read the book and find out. And now we're going to bring back this lovely mother and daughter duo who wrote the book, My Mother Always Says. We're learning life lessons from Gwen and how Amy applied them to her life, as well as all the great stuff that Amy's doing. So which way would you like to go, Amy and Gwen?
Yeah. Oh, I think one of the things I've learned, for example, working with hundreds of 9/11 widows, young women with young children whose husbands went to work and never came home, was a way to help them see that they had to do different things to reinvent their way of life and reinvent who they were. They weren't just mothers. They weren't just wives. And so this book is really a Bible that says, do not be afraid to follow your gut. Do not be afraid to fail. Do not be afraid. You've got to try different things, and reaching out somehow to another way of life, another way of thinking, is the only solution to living in this new world you have, whether it's as a widow or as a parent whose only child has died, that you have to reinvent who you are. And a lot of women, when their children grow up, don't know what to do with themselves. And that's what Amy's been harvesting and helping.
Right. So, good intro. So, yes. So, basically, what I do is I am an action coach for women. So, very often, I feel that women are very other-oriented. It's easier for us to care and pour our energy and resources into everybody else around us and not ourselves. So, I created a program called Drive Your Life, which I do annually. It's a virtual program on how to get women moving forward into action on one thing that really matters to them that they've been talking about and not doing. So that's part of what I do. And I also do all about the connections of women and creating community. And I feel like, well, I'm 65, but let's call it midlife. Would that be great? So I'm probably a little past midlife. But at midlife, a lot of women find that their circles are shrinking. It just happens naturally. And then what? And a lot of their purpose is gone if their parents, their children grow up. They, you know, it's the sort of job where if you do it well, you're out of a job, right? So I create women's events and gather women together. And I bring in women experts who are women entrepreneurs in all different fields. And we usually have 100 women in the room. We have 10 speakers. My mother speaks, I speak, and then 8 other people we don't know who are experts in different fields. And we do lunch and raffles, and it's a whole wonderful day. So I do that. And I created a community called Better Together Community, which is the same thing, but we do events together. And it's just really trying to create organic connections and give women a sense of purpose and fun. Like, whatever happened to fun? You know, we spent most of our lives caring for and nurturing other people and working. And what about the fun? And I think women are so focused on the to-do list, and much of their work is within the home, that they can't put it away. You know, a lot of men can come home and just enjoy like a fabulous weekend because their work is at work. Our work is right where we live. So it is hard to put all that away and have, you know, fun. So I do that. And I run travel for women. I do 3 or 4 or 5 trips a year. I create the trips. It's called Wandering Women. And I go on the trips, and we, you know, it's a way to connect and support women who want to travel. And so, like, those are, that's sort of my bag of tricks. And then we wrote this book. So the book now has really, like, I just want it to be visible. I want people to read it. I want it to be out there. We have a lot of great reviews on Amazon, which, of course, is heartwarming to us. Yeah, that's it. My Mother Always Says, 25 Lessons for Finding the Silver Lining. And we just created a card deck, which I didn't bring with me. I don't have with me, but it's beautiful. And each card has one of the 25 lessons. And on the back of the lesson is an action step that you, the reader, can take to incorporate that lesson in your own life. So it's really action. And then we have 3 blank ones at the end with an instruction card of how to add in maybe the lessons your mother taught you Mm-hmm. You're teaching your children the lesson and then an action step. So, you know, we don't want people to just, you know, put this thing on the shelf. Like and we're so grateful to you, Hillary, that you read it and you absorbed it. That's really what we want. It's a quick read. You know, people tell us all the time, oh my God, it's a quick read. And I say, yeah, because I want you to get through it and I want you to go back to it. So it has to be a quick read.
Can I go back? So you started a bakery when you were in your 20s, right?
Yeah.
And it sounds delicious. How did you get from there to here?
Yeah, people do like to know that. Yeah. So very briefly. Yeah. So I moved to Boston after I went to Cornell after college, and I worked in advertising because in those days, women started out as secretaries. Didn't matter where you went to school. It didn't matter what you did. You were type, type, type. You couldn't even get an interview without typing 40 words a minute or faster. I spent my time, instead of like polishing my resume, I was practicing typing because that was all that was open to me at that point. So I worked in advertising for 4 years. And toward the end of that, I did like sort of climb my way up to where I wanted to be. And I said, this isn't for me. It was very male dominated. It wasn't really my thing. So I left.
Right. Tell her about the case you made for the advertising agency.
Right.
Never mind.
So in the meantime, I loved decorating cakes. And my mother and I used to like with the squirt, the plastic plunger, nothing fancy. And so I really loved it. And I was decorating cakes through high school. She was telling you, I was bringing cakes into the secretary.
Did you bake the cakes too?
Baked them and decorated them. Yeah.
They're good.
And so then while I was working in advertising, I took a cake decorating course at a bakery and learned how to make beautiful, edible icing flowers. And I learned some sculpture techniques. And then I was bringing cakes in, like the homework. And then I taught a course all while I was in advertising. And I would bring the cakes into the ad agency and they would eat them. And everybody said, oh my God, you should open a bakery.
Remember the Celtics?
The Celtics.
Celtics. Yes.
Close. So one of the clients was Friendly's Restaurant. So I made a Friendly a cake, a 3D restaurant. And we had the Celtics. And I did a huge cake for them with Larry Bird's. Number 33 was the T-shirt and 3D sneakers. And it was wild. So then I opened this bakery, which was like Cake Boss. It was only cakes. It was not cookies and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. It was big sculpted corporate cakes for 1,000 people. Big, big, crazy stuff. So I left the agency to do that. And I had that business for 7 years and I built it up and we were doing wedding cakes at the Ritz and the Four Seasons. And we were doing huge cakes for
Remember
the city of Jerusalem for the
For Jordan Marsh. We did like
phenomenal.
A lot of like really crazy.
The aquarium.
The aquarium. Yeah. The aquarium's anniversary. And we served cake to 1,000 people at the aquarium that day. I mean, I'm saying it was big stuff. So I did all that. But in the middle of that, while I was doing that, I met my husband. No, actually, I met him before, but I got married. And then I had my first child. And then I was like, I want to be a stay-at-home mom, is what I decided. So I sold my bakery, called The Icing on the Cake, by the way, in Newton, Massachusetts, to two of my employees, and they still have it.
Fabulous.
So I had it for 7 years, and they now, my daughter that I sold it when she was born, is almost 33.
Wow.
So they had it for 32 years, and I had it for 7 years.
Wow.
There, and they've expanded, and they're amazing. They did my daughter's wedding cake.
Oh.
So that's kind of the story of that. And then I was a stay-at-home mom for almost like 18, 20 years. And I had 3 children and I was raising money for playgrounds. You know, I was doing entrepreneurial things, but not for pay.
Mm-hmm.
Volunteering. And then I came, my youngest was then in middle school. So I couldn't keep saying I'm a stay-at-home mom because nobody was home. One was in college, one was in high school, and one was in middle school. She was never home. So I became a health coach for a big nationwide company and started a team and coach and did all these things. And then I started, that was at 53 when I was 53. And then at 60, like a little over 5 years ago, I started this action coaching, Drive Your Life, and this whole business that I do now with women.
Wow.
I got there in a very short story.
So we are both believers in new careers for women at any age.
Right. That's true. Right.
Yeah.
All right.
That's true.
To use your ability, your life story, your skills to start something different if you're not afraid to fail. So not make it an age thing either. certainly a gender thing. It's not, but it's not an age thing. And it's not even a stage of life thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. New careers for women in any, that's a really good point. That's a good tie-in, Mom.
Well, my next book is going to be about my next career.
And what will it be?
It's a secret.
Yeah. I mean, really, if you do think about it, at 44, you became a social worker.
Right.
At 53, I became a health coach. At 60, I created this action coaching. And at 93, you just wrote your first book. I mean, that's astonishing. I mean, like, even saying it out loud is kind of wild.
Yeah.
I don't know. When I grow up, I may do another job. Who knows?
But you guys don't seem to be afraid to start things. Like you said, you're not afraid to fail, which I think most people.
Oh, that's the secret. If you're,
you know,
nothing happens.
Well, that's all lessons.
That's the lesson.
So how did you go from health coach to action coach? You just like,
yeah, so happened. Yeah. So I was a health coach. Again, as I said, it was under the umbrella of a big nationwide program. And I built a big business out of it. I had coaches under me and I was training them, and I had hundreds and hundreds of clients. Like it was a full-time gig, let's just say. And then my youngest was going away to college. She wasn't going that far away, and she was going to college, and we were very close because she was 6 years younger than the next one. So, you know, she was like, it was just the two of us for many years. And I just didn't want to be on top of her. I just worried that if I didn't come up with something that really got me excited, I just wouldn't be able to allow her to separate. So the health coaching, though I loved it for what it was, I wanted to do something on my own, and I wanted to really focus on women. So I eased out of that. And then I just said, I'm going to be an action coach. And it's literally, you know what it is? It's opening the parachute on the way down. Like, I came up with the idea of Drive Your Life. I created the whole thing in my head, like what you did with the bereavement center. And then I started promoting it. And, you know, someone said, are you going to run it as a program? And I was like, okay. And then I just did it. And then it was 5 weeks. And at the end of 5 weeks, I was like, that's not long enough. So I said to the group, the beta group, want to go, I think it needs another 4 weeks. And I said, okay. You know, and we just kept going. And, you know, that's how you do things. You just, it's okay to be afraid, but do it anyway. Is what I say.
That's great. And the trips, when did you start the travel trips?
Yeah. So when I was in the middle of this Drive Your Life program, somebody said, have you ever thought of doing a retreat? Oh, could you do a retreat? And I said, okay. And I did my first retreat. And then I did another one a whole year later. So it was a long time because it took a lot out of me. And it was also during COVID. So I did one a whole year later. And then someone said, well, couldn't you just do women's travel? Because the retreats had a whole coaching.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was very powerful, but it didn't feel as relaxing, I think, to that, because there was a lot of like introspection or whatever. So someone said, can't you just do women's like a trip? And I said, okay. And then I just started doing travel. And then I realized that women were looking for this. Like, I'm always looking for the need, and there was a need. And so I just kept ramping it up and ramping it up. And here we are today.
Wow.
The motto.
Congratulations. Unbelievable. All right. We have.
Our motto could always be, always say, yes, I can.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I think she just says, okay.
Okay.
Okay. Whatever. Yeah, okay. Just like you said with the bereavements in it. But yeah, yes, I can is great. So we have 2 minutes left. I'll give each of you a minute to say, you know, what would you like to leave people with? What, you know, if the world could be any way you wanted it to be, what would it look like? Who wants to go first?
Careful.
You don't want to hear what I would say about that.
Well, what do you want to leave people with?
What I want to leave people with is the ability to say, whatever is happening to you, it's going to be a piece of knowledge that you can use to make your life better. Whatever is happening, say a stained glass window, each piece will come together and be the story of your life. So utilize every experience that comes your way. There are no bad experiences.
I love that.
Thank you.
So glad we recorded that.
So am I.
Yeah. That's been. I would say that action, any action, always feels better than no action. So when you're concerned or you're worried or you're thinking about something or you might want to do something or just don't know, just do it. Do something. Because moving forward, getting in action always feels better than being stagnant and feeling uncomfortable, because what are you going to do? Do something. Read a book, call a friend, take a walk, research something. I don't know what, but bake a cake. But do something and just push yourself to just get started. And I think the rest of it really can flow.
That's really important, because doing nothing is a sign of helplessness.
Mm.
You say, there's nothing I can do. That's despair. You could always do something. Amy's absolutely right. Bake a cake is a good one, too.
All right. Well, thank you to the authors of My Mother Always Says. And Amy, just before we leave, how do they find you? Is it on?
Well, they can find me at my website, which is my name, Amy Goober, AmyGoober. Everything is on there. And the book you can find on anywhere you can buy books online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other online booksellers.
All right, great. So AmyGoober.com. Thank you so much, ladies, for your lessons, for your wisdom, and for your amazing can-do attitude. So thank you.
And thank you, Hillary, because you obviously have a can-do attitude also.
Yes, I do.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony, and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together if you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.